As of today, we are on day 18 of a federal government shutdown. 18 days without access to the services the federal government provides, and 18 days without jobs and paychecks for federal government employees. Now, we've seen shutdowns before, 21 of them to be precise, since the 1970s. That's when the shutdown first became a tactic in the budget negotiation process. But 18 days is a really long time, and there's not much sign of compromise. Democrats are blaming Republicans, Republicans are blaming Democrats, and then there's this.
If we don't get what we want, one way or the other, whether it's through you, through a military, through anything you want to call, I will shut down the government.
Okay, absolutely. Fair enough.
So, while politicians argue, people's day-to-day lives and long-term plans are up in the air. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR's Central Standard, we'll hear stories from Kansas Cityans to get a sense of what day 18 of a shutdown looks like here in town. Call 816-235-2888 if you have a story to share. 816-235-2888. We will start with the story of a new brewery that was supposed to open in February, but crucial parts of the plan are now in limbo, and that could spell financial disaster. James Stutzman of City Barrel Brewing, welcome to the show.
Morning.
Sorry, it's not under better circumstances. tell me the story, first of all, behind your decision to open a brewery. Like, what was the vision?
Well, myself and one of my business partners, we've been in the beer business for a long time. I worked for another local brewery here in town, Kansas City Beer Company, then worked for a national brewery. So just really got to know the world of beer. And we're fortunate that we live in Kansas City, and it's a great town for beer.
Is there a not great town for beer, though?
Well, we're fortunate that Boulevard has trained us all what good beer is. And so we thought it'd be a great idea to make a bunch of IPAs and sours and have a restaurant as well.
So can you tell me how you envisioned your opening and the build up to it before you caught wind of a possible shutdown?
Well, a big part of our project is we invested $100,000 in a beautiful new canning line. And a big part of our portfolio is canned beer to go because, well, there's nothing more beautiful than that in your backyard. We planned on doing lots of can parties to kind of raise awareness. And the fun thing is that with the government shutdown, the regulating body that we have to submit all of our labels to get approved by is shut down.
So back up for me, though. Over what period of time have you been planning for an opening of a business where a crucial part of it is canned beer to go? Can you explain what kind of planning and preparation has gone into that?
Well, absolutely. We started this project a year and a half ago. I left my job at Deschutes Brewery in February to work on this full time. So I've been what I like to call fun employed for a long time. So we've been working on this, and we just literally just Friday, we figured out when we can actually launch and finish the construction. And
so is there wiggle room in your period of fun employment? Like, if that extends longer than anticipated, what does that mean for you?
Well, I don't get a paycheck until we open the doors. So my wife would very much like it if we were able to get going. And the other thing is we're going to have about 40 employees. That this was supposed to be a big part of our portfolio. And, yeah, that's just things we can't do now.
So, wait, did you have 40 people lined up and hired with start dates?
We have 8 people full-time right now, and then the rest will be starting about 2 weeks before we open on February 22nd.
So, explain a little more, in some more detail, how the shutdown is interfering with this.
Well, a big part of our portfolio is going to be craft beer in cans available to go directly on site. And that was important for us from a revenue stream standpoint, as well as a marketing, because we're not going to distribute. So we're not going to send beer to restaurants and bars and liquor stores. So being able to have people come in and take our beer to go is very...
Buy it straight from you.
Correct. Exactly. So that was very important. And the cans were how we're going to do that. And now we are affected by the shutdown because all beer labels for packaging has to be approved by the federal government. And the agency that approves them is shut down right now. And so it normally takes around 21 days to get an approval, but there are 7,000 craft breweries in the country now. And that backlog is going to be pretty long by the time that they get up and running. So I don't know when I'll have the rest of the cans approved.
What do you see as your options?
Basically, I get to look at this beautiful canning line for a while, and we'll still be able to open because we'll still have draft beer, but we won't be able to send anything out the doors. Everybody will just have to come hang out and drink and eat on site only.
I mean, most beer that I buy does get consumed within a pretty reasonable time period. So I'm not super clear on what happens if canned beer just sits there, but you haven't talked about that, and I am curious about it. Like, you've got this product that you are releasing to the world, their first taste of what you've been working on. You intended for it to go out at a certain time. It's fermented, but is it somewhat perishable also?
So that actually is really funny because, well, yeah, we have beer in tanks. We're getting ready. And one of the first beer we made it's an IPA. IPAs are meant to be drank fresh. And because of this delay and not knowing when I can can it, we're actually going to create a couple events and have people in for some private events, and I can't sell it. I can't package it. So we're just going to give it away for free.
Well, I mean, big picture, do you think that I know that this is a very scary question, but it's one you have to have asked yourself. Do you think that this government shutdown could truly spell financial disaster for you?
We are nimble and small. So no, I don't think so. Because we have the restaurant side and we have the draft side that we can use, but it's a big part of our business that we can't do right now. We'll figure it out because we're that's how we roll. But I don't sleep much.
Yeah, I mean, can you say more about how you are emotionally handling this uncertainty?
Oh, well, my poor wife gets to hear about it a lot, and my poor business partners and I. We probably have too many beers because of it.
You know, I mean, I want to say this is not just about whether Kansas City has to wait for a new brewery, which might sound very frivolous. You've invested time and money and energy into a new business venture. That is a really scary thing anyway.
Absolutely. This is a big project. So we're the brewery facility, we're producing 500 gallons at a time. We're a 15-barrel brewery. We have these beautiful oak, they're called fooders. They're basically 1,000-gallon wine tanks for sour beer, which are very expensive. The brewing equipment is very expensive. And then we have the audacity to do amazing food on top of that. So we built a restaurant from scratch. We have 125 seats in the restaurant. And, yeah, all of that adds up to a lot of money we had to raise in order to finance this. It's troubling.
From your vantage point, is there something that you understand about the whole government shutdown scenario, having now lived it for 18 days, that you maybe didn't quite get from watching it play out on the news in the past?
As you hear it on the news and you hear people are affected and, you know, you feel bad, but until you actually get stuck in that situation, you can't really empathize as well. And I mean, like you said, Gina, I get to make craft beer. It's a luxury item. It's affecting me, and I can only imagine how much it affects other people because, again, we get to make beer. It's really fun. It's cool. But, you know, that's people's lives.
James Stutzman, thanks so much.
Absolutely.
James is the founder of City Barrel Brewery, set to open soonish, and the shutdown has put a lot of his plans in limbo. Of course, a lot of the people affected by a shutdown like this are federal employees, and there are tons of them in Kansas City, like the woman who left this message on our voicemail.
I am a federal employee who's been affected tremendously. As a matter of fact, I just borrowed money against my pension in order to pay my monthly bills.
We'll be calling this woman Ms. Johnson today. She has asked to go by last name only. She's here to tell her story now. Ms. Johnson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So, what do you do for the federal government?
I work for an agency that does grant management. We work with local governments as well as nonprofit agencies. We do grant management, financial management. We approve vouchers for payment. Those are just some of the small things we do, but they have far-reaching implications into Kansas as well as Western Missouri.
What kinds of implications?
Well, when you think about how federal funds are awarded, the federal applications have to be a reviewed process, then agreements have to be drawn up. Once those agreements are in place, grantees, depending on the system of approval, with the agency that I work for, we have to approve vouchers in order for agencies to be reimbursed for local governments and cities if they are using formula grant funding. Those requests for release of funds have to be reviewed to ensure compliance with federal regulations. So the opportunity for local governments to use federal dollars in order to assist low-income individuals to deal with economic development and other approved projects, those are not being done. So you have many people out in your listening area who are directly impacted by this simply because there are no federal employees to be able to do these tasks.
So federal employees like you, I mean, this affects you not just in the work that you find really important not being done, but also in your paychecks not coming in.
It's extremely difficult to continue to keep focus on something positive when you hear all of this conflicting rhetoric coming out of Washington. As a federal employee, I work at the behest of Congress and the President. I have worked in Democratic and Republican administrations and have gone through two partial shutdowns. And it is quite unsettling. My background is in nonprofit management. I've worked in nonprofit all my life. And I believe in I believe in being a public servant. I believe in the importance of civic engagement on every level, particularly when you have an opportunity to give back and help people that are in need of help. But right now, federal employees are in need of some reason in Washington. We are in need of someone to speak for us, to not be used as political bargaining chips. We are individuals who have families to take care of. We may be helping our parents. We may have just bought a home or had a new child.
I mean, what about you? Do any of these things apply to you?
This is kind of interesting because I joined the federal government actually in my 50s. As I said, I had numerous years working in nonprofit management, and as I got older, I wanted to see if I could find a place where my skill sets could be utilized, where I would have a more steady paycheck and not have to worry about whether my job was going to end because the grant funding went out, and made a sacrifice. Actually, I've moved 3 times for opportunities for career advancement. And right now, you know, I thought that I would be looking at working maybe 10 more years in the federal government and being able to retire and having something to retire on. But I can't keep doing what I'm doing because I don't know whether or not there's going to be funding to pay me. And so right now, you know, I'm seriously taking a look at stepping outside the federal government, because when you're told that you cannot work, you are on furlough and there will be no pay, there will be no relief. You know, it's an eye-opening experience.
There's a lot of uncertainty in that, even if you've done all the planning in the world.
Exactly. Because if you have an emergency, if you need to take, care of a loved one, if you need to do certain things, emergency arises. And in the best laid plans, you can't prepare for something like this.
I mean, you told us that you have borrowed money against your pension to cover monthly bills. Can you take me to the decision to do that, looking at your options? Take me through what that was like.
I'm laughing not because it's funny, but because of the fact that, you know, once you start looking at what you have to work with financially and what you need for the next coming month, I had to bite the bullet and contact the agency that works with our pension to make those arrangements. I didn't want to do that, but I have no confidence. I'm unsure that I don't know when this crisis is going to be averted, and I want to prepare to make sure that I have money to pay my bills in February.
You know, we spoke with a couple of people in preparation for the show who weren't able to actually be here today. And I want to share with you a couple of things we heard, just because I am guessing with all the people you work with, maybe you've heard stories like this. You know, we've heard from someone who is an IRS employee who also works in a HUD-funded housing. And so she is doubly affected by the shutdown. We also heard from someone who his wife works for the federal government. They are kind of wrestling with, okay, do we try to file for unemployment, which maybe we will be expected to pay back later, which then will be an extra bill? Or, you know, do we try to see if we qualify for food stamps? Well, that whole program is in limbo. So just all of these sort of questions of how do I deal with this, not knowing not only when I will be going back to work, but also what the policy will be with whatever plans I've made in the interim. Like, if I take unemployment while I'm technically employed, will I owe it back?
The essential personnel, the federal workers who are classified as personnel, even though this is a financial burden for essential employees to go to work without being compensated, once a shutdown is ended, they will be compensated. But for employees that are classified as non-essential, that is not guaranteed. And I'm a non-essential employee. For the contractors who work for the federal government, they will not be reimbursed for this. There is no maybe for them.
I mean, when you borrow against your pension, are you concerned that your retirement plans might change?
Yes, because I'm not going to be able to retire at the time that I would like to. I'm going to have to continue to work until I can't.
Ms. Johnson, I hope that this all works out okay for you. Thank you so much for telling your story.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And to all of the listeners out there who have friends and or family who are in this situation, please be supportive of them.
Ms. Johnson is a federal employee in Kansas City, and she's borrowed money against her pension to pay her bills. We're going to take a break shortly, but I want to talk quickly with Jenny, who has called us at 816-235-2888. That's how you can get your story in on this conversation as well. Jenny in Kansas City, good morning.
Hi, good morning. Gina, thank you for having me on the show. I am an attorney with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and I need to preface my comments with the disclaimer that I'm speaking only for myself and any views I express are mine, not those of the CFTC. I also want to tell your listeners that I'm not here to take any political position or to assign blame. I'm just here to say that I and other federal employees like Ms. Johnson are hurt by this situation, and we shouldn't be because it's not our fault. I've been furloughed since December 22nd, so I will not be receiving my regularly scheduled paycheck on Saturday. My situation is compounded by the fact that my husband is also a federal employee, so we are completely without pay in our family right now. Unlike me, he is considered essential, which means that he's working without pay during the shutdown. I'm very concerned about our financial affairs. Ms. Johnson touched on this, that the accepted and essential employees will eventually be paid for their work, so there's some comfort for us knowing that. But if we're not back to work on Monday, I too will be making the phone calls to my retirement account to borrow money to make sure that I can meet all my bills for the month of February.
You know, you gave a lot of disclaimers when you first started speaking, and I am wondering if this is a scary thing for you to also talk about.
No, I don't think it's a scary thing for me to talk about, but I am an attorney, so I'm sort of disclaimer type of person. And again, I don't want anyone to think that I'm blaming my employer because I'm not. We didn't ask to be shut down. We that's our message is that we want to go back to work and we don't want to lose pay for a situation over which we have no control.
Jenny, thank you so much for your call.
The taxpayers deserve better.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can call 816-235-2888 with your story. We'd love to hear from you if the government shutdown is affecting your life personally and directly. We're going to talk to one of our reporters when we return about contractors for the federal government and airport security. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and we're talking about the federal government shutdown on day 18. We're hearing stories from people in Kansas City directly affected by this shutdown. Now let's talk to Sam Zeff. Sam is a reporter here at KCUR, and he's been talking to contractors for the federal government. Hi, Sam.
Morning, Gina.
So who are we talking about here? What kinds of things do people do as contract workers for the federal government?
Well, one thing that's true about the federal government is that they buy everything. The two contractors that I focused on this week both have a lot of Defense Department contracts. One of them is called MedVolt. It's based in Colorado Springs, but just opened a Kansas City office to do Defense Department contracting around here. They're doing a project at Fort Riley. The other is Infinite Energy Construction. That's down in Martin City. They do a lot of federal government contracting. They're also in the private sector. They're doing some of the work on the new condos and apartments down on the riverfront. But they do an awful lot of business with the Department of Defense and other places. And right now, they're okay. Unlike federal employees who are looking at no paycheck on Friday, these small business contractors will generally invoice once a month and then get paid. So they're okay through the end of this month. It's at the end of this month when they start to send out invoices, whether it's going to get a little dicey about whether they're going to get paid for jobs that they are currently doing at federal installations all around the country.
So what are you hearing from them about how they are affected and how,
There is some sweat, but there isn't panic. So right now, they're able to pay their people, they're able to pay their subcontractors, they're able to pay their own employees because they've been paid on these contracts. Because some of these small businesses do business outside of the federal government, there is some cash flow that they have coming into the business. However, there is, as we get to the end of the month, if their primary contracting is with the federal government, then it's a little scary. Now, DOD contracts, if they are mission critical, as they like to say in the federal government, some of that money will continue to flow. But, for example, with Infinite Energy Construction, they have some FAA contracts, Federal Aviation Administration, that may not continue. The problem here, as we heard from Ms. Johnson, is that people who administer these contracts, who actually make these payments happen, may have been furloughed. One of the issues right now is the uncertainty of who in the federal government is working. Some people just aren't sure who is critical. We know that there are some FAA issues, right? But who is furloughed? Who is getting paid? Who is there to make sure that these contracts are being paid? So right now, there is more confusion than sweat. What's going to happen? They're not really sure.
Sam, I want to talk to you about the airport stuff, but I first want to turn to one of our callers at 816-235-2888. We've got Cloretta with us from Kansas City, Missouri. Hi, Cloretta.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. How about you?
Oh, good. Pretty good.
Tell me your story.
Well, it has been kind of difficult with, contacting creditors, letting them know that I'm not going to meet some of my commitments on time. And also, I'm a member at Mazuma Credit Union, and for federal employees, they have a HOPE loan that you have to request. You don't see the information when you log onto their website.
Wait, what is a HOPE loan?
Well, it's Mazuma will loan federal employees that are members their last direct deposit amount for 60 days interest free.
Okay.
And they did this for us back in 2013 as well when we had a shutdown.
Can you tell me what you do for the federal government?
I'm an accountant.
An accountant for any particular department?
Department of Agriculture.
So there's this piece of it that for you involves creditors, which, I mean, I'm guessing that your credit can be severely, in addition to paying for things, that's one piece of it, that your credit could also be damaged going forward if you're having to deal with creditors.
That's right, yes, because the creditors that I called said, you know, okay, thanks for calling us, we understand, but you're still going to be assessed a late fee. And, you know, they said you can call in and request that it be removed, but there's no guarantee that it will be.
Can you tell me also, like, in the work you do, what is it that you are usually doing that isn't happening right now?
I work on three different programs, the Farm Storage Facility Loan Program, the Boll Weevil Eradication Program, and the Farm Storage Microloan Program. So those programs, the Farm Storage Program gives low-interest loans to farmers to build silos and those types of structures to store their grain and other commodities. And but also in our area, also at my agency, we have the Market Facilitation Program, which is a program that was created last fall to assist farmers with their expenses and the losses that they've incurred because of the tariffs that have been assessed. And the program was an assistance, but it still does not cover all of what the farmers have lost due to the tariffs. So now they have that, you know, the shutdown where there's nobody in the offices that are going to be able to help them to give them these loans. So they don't even have that help either.
Wow. So, yeah, you not being at work affects you personally, and it also might affect a lot of farmers in our area.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, Cloretta, thank you for your call, and I wish you the best of luck, and I wish I could say more to you than that.
Oh, yeah. Thank you. And thank you for doing this.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye.
We've got one more call I want to take from Joanne in Pleasant Hill. Hi, Joanne.
Good morning.
What is your story?
I work at the White House Decision Center at the Truman Presidential Library and Museum. The White House Decision Center is a simulation-based exercise and based one of five major decisions in President Truman's administration. And we primarily work with school groups. And so the shutdown, because we are shut down, the White House Decision Center shut down, is affecting not just the adult groups that we scheduled at the White House Decision Center, but our school groups. For example, Sabetha Kansas was supposed to be here today to work on assimilation in the White House Decision Center. That's been canceled. Grandview was supposed to be here on Friday. That group has been canceled because of the shutdown. East High School is also scheduled to be there, and they've been canceled.
So
as long as the shutdown is in operation, our White House Decision Center cannot function, and we're having to cancel school groups right and left.
Can you tell me what goes into school groups being able to go on these field trips? Because I'm just not sure, with not working in your field, how likely it is that they will be able to reschedule, come back some other time. Like, how is this actually affecting these groups
of
students?
That'll be very difficult to do, because starting around February or March, if the shutdown ends, we'll have almost every date filled.
How do the kids who have been planning to come on these field trips, how have they been preparing? Have they been looking forward to this, doing curriculum that leads up to it?
Absolutely. They have advanced modules, about four of them, to prepare them to come to the White House Decision Center to participate in this role-playing simulation.
So this is the culmination of their studies at school?
Exactly.
I can hear the passion in your voice around this. Can you just talk to me about what it is you're feeling?
I feel a lot of anger, I think, more than anything, because it's affecting a lot of groups, a lot of government and private businesses, as you brought forth on your show. And I think that people do not realize how far-reaching this shutdown is and how many places or things or people are affected. For example, the employees at the Truman Presidential Library and Museum. They're affected because they are furloughed.
Well,
as well as our young people who are scheduled to participate in this fabulous simulation.
Joanne, thank you so much for calling. I really had not thought about that there are students out there in schools who have been working toward field trips that they may never take, which is, a sad thing when you compound it with people not receiving pay and things like that. Sam Zeff, thank you for wading through some more of these stories from Kansas Cityans. We were talking just as we turned to those callers about what's going on at the airport.
Right. So we heard even this morning there was a piece on NPR out of Chicago about how TSA agents in Transportation Security Administration admitted that they're having more call-ins for sick time because these TSA screeners are not being paid. The question is, how does that affect KCI, if at all? KCI is one of those airports where security screening is contracted out to a private company, in this case a global company called Accol. I've been in contact with KCI officials, and they say that so far they have not seen an increase in call-outs for sick time by screeners. This could be because that money, those screeners may still get paid because that contract has been paid probably through the end of this month. I've made a couple of attempts to talk to them. They have not called back. TSA said that they are not seeing any problems with any of these other contracted airports. There's maybe a dozen around the country. So right now, if you go to KCI, you're probably going to see the regular number of screeners. The question is, and I haven't been able to get this question answered from TSA or Accol, and KCI may not know, is whether or not at the end of this month, will Accol get paid by the federal government so that they can continue to pay these screeners that work at KCI. That seems to be in limbo right now. But unlike like we've heard at Chicago O'Hare or at LaGuardia, where there was apparently a sick out, that does not seem to be the case right now at KCI.
Sam, so many of the news information pieces that you've just told us today have this caveat of through the end of the month, everything is fine. How much conversation is there with the people you're speaking with about do people worry that it will extend past the end of the month? That would be an extremely long government shutdown, but who knows?
Right. The thing with a lot of these contractors is that they work also outside of the government realm. So the real question is, will it interfere with cash flow? And so just like your own household accounts or Ms. Johnson, first thing you're going to do is turn to your savings. How much money do these companies have in the bank? After that, there are short-term loans. They can open up a line of credit. In some cases, maybe tap into your pension. After that, it gets really dicey and maybe becomes untenable.
Sam Zeff, thank you so much for joining me from the newsroom to talk about this.
My pleasure, Gina.
And thanks to everyone who participated in this shutdown conversation on KCUR's Central Standard. We'll have the audio ready by the end of the day at kcur.org/Central Standard. And if you didn't get your story in, but you still want to, email it. We're centralstandard@kcur.org. Coming up, a new book of little-known chapters in the crazy Pendergast story. We'll hear one about a hospital. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard, and now we're shifting our focus from the federal government of today to city government under Pendergast. A new book is out. It's called Wide Open Town, Kansas City in the Pendergast Era, and every chapter takes a really deep dive into some aspect of Kansas City under Pendergast that tends to get overlooked. Today, we are talking with the author of a chapter on Kansas City's Black Public Hospital, General Hospital No. 2, and the story of that hospital is tied up with the Pendergast machine, it turns out. Jason Rowe, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for being here. What was General Hospital No. 2 for people who have never heard of it?
General Hospital No. 2 was the Black public hospital, taxpayer funded in Kansas City.
What years?
It began in 1908. It took the place in the old public hospital that had served both whites and black patients. But they wanted a segregated facility that would have black doctors serving black patients. There was more trust that way.
Was this unusual looking at cities in America, especially segregated cities in America at this time?
It was extraordinarily unusual. In fact, when the new General Hospital building opened in 1930, it was the only public hospital in the United States that was built specifically for African Americans and fully staffed and administered by African Americans.
The title of this chapter is "As Good as Money Could Buy." That's a quote, but what's it about? What does it mean?
The full quote, it came from Chester Arthur Franklin, and it was, "They did not try to build something good enough for Negroes, but something as good as money could buy." And this came out of a Republican-leading newspaper. Of course, Tom Pendergast was a Democrat. Pendergast supported the hospital. So it really meant something for the opposition to Pendergast to praise it this way. And of course, there's a little bit of irony to this statement as well, that it's as good as money could buy. But there were certainly problems associated with corruption in the machine.
Explain that, because so far it might not be clear. And in fact, you know, I have heard the story of this hospital. I had never heard it associated with Pendergast. What does Pendergast have to do with this?
There was a tremendous political impact with the hospital. We have a couple of chapters in our book from Professors John McCurley and Jeff Pasley that detail this. They talk about the importance of the black vote at the time. The full state of Missouri and Kansas City as well was a swing state. they're pretty evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats. So at the time, a minority, the black vote, if it could be shifted from one direction to the next, then it would have an impact. So that was the advantage to the machine of supporting African-Americans, Irish and Italian immigrants, working-class whites. Who had
so this is not like a secretly like magnanimous and like warm and fuzzy side of Pendergast we have not heretofore known. This is, like everything else, leverage.
Correct. For example, when Pendergast took control of the city government, he placed his city manager, Henry McElroy, in charge of the health department director. McElroy immediately fired the health department director. Supposedly, it was because of a dispute over the color of paint at the White Public Hospital, which was General Hospital Number 1. Obviously, it went beyond paint. It was political.
So when you think about this story of how race and healthcare and the Pendergast machine come together, there is actually like a lot of sort of fond remembering of this hospital in terms of the careers it supported of African Americans in healthcare, whether it be as physicians, as nurses, as clerical staff in the hospital, the careers it supported, you know, but the idea that that would be tied to political corruption might be really disheartening for people to hear.
Yeah. And I think that the political corruption did not interfere with a sense of community pride in this institution, because the African American community, they lobbied for this, they earned this. It was wise. They had leaders such as William Tompkins, who was a Democrat and a doctor. He was in charge of the hospital, and he ended up rising really pretty far in the ranks of the Democratic Party, especially in this Midwestern region.
Yeah, people, there was legitimacy in the careers people earned.
Yes. They were certainly right to be proud of this institution that they had earned for the city.
What was the fate of the hospital sort of bound up, though, then, with the fate of Pendergast's tenure in Kansas City?
It certainly was. When Pendergast went to jail, a number of things happened. The hospital lost accreditation for the internship program, and it
came out.
Can you
tell me about the internship program there?
The internship program was huge at the time, and this kind of speaks to the significance of Missouri as a whole, because Kansas City and St. Louis also had a public hospital that kind of followed a few years after. And between those two cities, they accounted for fully half of the interns who were trained after their medical training.
So how did you get interested in this story?
I first got interested in this story when I did an internship at the Kansas City Public Library. It was 10 years ago at this point. It was in the summer, and I wrote this series of articles called This Week in Kansas City History. And one of those topics was this. And when we were putting together the book and the website at the library, the Pendergast Years, Kansas City and the Jazz Age and Great Depression, this seemed like a perfect topic to kind of fill in and flesh out what some of these racial and political issues meant.
You work now as the digital history specialist at the Kansas City Public Library, so I know that Pendergast has to come up pretty regularly in your life. Like, if you have a question about why something is the way it is in Kansas City, Pendergast is a very solid guess if you do not know the answer. You know what I mean?
Yes. Yes.
So as someone with a lot of who spends a lot of time dealing in Kansas City history and the way we usually talk about Pendergast here, what do you think this book does differently?
This book, it goes beyond Pendergast in a lot of ways. I mean, there are biographies of Pendergast, and they focus on Pendergast the man. We're looking at Pendergast, the era. Kansas City, the era. So Pendergast is always kind of in the background of our book. He's sort of lurking there. He comes up every 10 or 20 pages. And
this is a great metaphor for life in Kansas City.
Yeah,
he's just lurking there.
So we have all of these chapters about jazz and women activists and so on and so forth.
Cross-dressing in the Pendergast era.
That is correct. We have a chapter about female impersonation.
This is a big, dense book, and I am working my way through it. Have you read the whole thing?
Yes. I am one of the three co-editors of the book, so I was forced to go through and check for errant commas and things of that nature.
So you have read the whole thing. And I am wondering about if there is a chapter or two that really opened your eyes to something you hadn't quite realized or considered before about Kansas City or the Pendergast era.
I think probably the second chapter, which was Professor Jeff Pasley, and I referenced it before, and that's how Tom Pendergast created this coalition that resembled the national coalition that Franklin Roosevelt put together. And that, of course, involved minorities, African-American, Irish, Italian, other immigrants, and, of course, organized labor.
Can you explain that a little bit more? Why that's significant?
Of course, that's significant because it happened in Kansas City and, to an extent, statewide in Missouri. Pendergast was able to build this coalition really in the 1920s and extend his influence even out into Missouri. He was able to get governors elected. Most famously, he got Harry S. Truman elected senator. And of course, everyone knows that Truman went on to become president of the United States. And as I mentioned, Franklin Roosevelt, I don't know if he was looking at Kansas City or not. I don't think we have a smoking gun showing him doing that. But his coalition nationally certainly echoed Tom Pendergast's.
Did you ever watch House of Cards?
I have to admit that I have not.
Just when you think about the way we talk about political corruption today, do you think that this book sheds light on today's conversations in any way? Just because you aren't talking necessarily, like you've said, about Pendergast himself or the corruption itself. You're talking about sort of cultural influence.
After the fall of Pendergast, obviously there was corruption. There were deaths associated with the machine. The city went through kind of a low point, at least culturally. All of the jazz clubs had shut down. Downtown became kind of a ghost town as white people moved out to the suburbs. The money followed away from the center of downtown. As everybody who lives here, I think, is kind of aware that it was dead downtown and in the crossroads and other places. But starting in the 1990s, early 2000s, there's been this resurgence, and it's obviously not the same. I don't believe that we have the level of corruption that we had back then, thankfully. But I think it's kind of a takeaway lesson. There's certain echoes of history in our present moment.
Just like be careful what you build your successes on? Is that the lesson that you're alluding to?
I believe so, yes. It's we can learn a lot from this time period that it's a time when Kansas City was a top 25 in terms of population city, and it had vibrancy and relevancy in the jazz scene and others. And I think today we're at least duplicating that on a somewhat smaller scale.
Do you... is there one more chapter you just want to hint at before we go?
A random one that springs to mind is about the stockyards and African-American workers in the stockyards and their organized labor movements. And there's strikes and violence, and this was John Herron, professor who wrote it, UMKC professor, and he's one of the co-editors of the volume, so I've worked really closely with him throughout the project, and that's one that you can really, it just has this deep kind of emotional impact when I read it, about because it's very visceral.
Well, Jason Rowe, our time is up. Thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Jason will be speaking tonight at the Kansas City Public Library along with some of his fellow contributors to Wide Open Town, Kansas City in the Pendergast Era. The talk is at the Plaza branch of the library at 6:30 this evening. Jason wrote a chapter about General Hospital No. 2, Kansas City's Black Public Hospital. And that's a wrap for today's show. Listen back to anything you might have missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. Tomorrow, we are typical around here, a study that set out to find the most typical counties in America. America found four of them in our listening area on both sides of the state line. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rao with Suzanne Hogan, Coy Duggar, Chris Young, and intern Salisa Kalakal. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman.